UCR podcast.
The Experience Hendrix Tour is getting ready to kick things off in March, and if you've never had the pleasure of attending a show, boy, it is indeed quite the experience, and it's the only authorized multi-artist celebration of the music of Jimi Hendrix. It's an idea which first started taking shape in 1995 with a series of destination events that eventually led up to the first proper tour dates in 2004 and 2007. And here in 2025, the trek returns to the road following fall 2024 concert dates that marked the first proper Experience Hendrix tour since 2019. This year's outing features newcomer Marcus King alongside Experience Hendrix veterans Zakk Wylde, Eric Johnson, Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Samantha Fish, Chris Stone, Kingfish Ingram, Devin Allman, and others. They will play their first show March 11th in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I was happy to be able to get on the phone with John McDermott, who has been the catalog director for Experience Hendrix LLC for more than three decades. He's been a part of some really cool projects in that time, including the 1993 All-Star Tribute album Stone Free. And if you're like me, you had a copy of that CD back in the 90s, and we definitely discussed that during our conversation. He's written four books about Hendrix, including his most recent one, Jimmy, which he co-authored with Jimmy's sister, Janie. That book was released in 2022, and we talk about the recent box set, Electric Lady Studios, A Jimi Hendrix Vision, and John takes us inside the vaults to talk about some of the things that have been released over the years and what might be coming up in the future. I enjoyed speaking with John, and it sent me down quite a rabbit hole revisiting a lot of Jimmy's music. There are more than two dozen cities on the schedule for this spring's touring plans, and you can find a show near you by visiting the official website, experiencehendrixtour.com. And of course, we have written a lot about Jimi Hendrix at Ultimate Classic Rock, so make sure to visit the site and go down your own rabbit hole. If this is the first time you've heard the UCR podcast, give us a follow, and you'll get new episodes as they are released. And if you enjoy what we're doing here, take a moment to rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate it. Here is our conversation with John McDermott about the music of Jimi Hendrix. How are you?
I'm doing fine, man. How are you doing?
Great, man. Excited to talk to you about all this stuff. And boy, it's always a pleasure each year when Experience Hendrix goes back out on the road. I've seen the show a number of times, and I got to tell you, John, it's just amazing that they managed to put a fresh spin on all this stuff. And, you know, some folks might look at this and go, isn't that going to be too much Jimi Hendrix in one night? But it never is. It almost feels like not enough, man. It's just a fun ride each year, and you know, always kind of fun to see the different surprises that are, you know, in store. So I guess
fun, man. It's just a lot of fun to do. But yeah, no, I'll answer your question whenever you're ready to go. But to directly answer what you're saying, it's a blast to be able to do it.
What are you kind of excited about this this year's particular, you know, lineup and tour that's headed out next month?
Well, for me, I mean, we haven't done this tour since 2019. We did at the fall of last year, we did the West Coast. This year we're doing the East Coast. And, you know, so to be able to go back out there and do it again is great. To be able to have artists Marcus King, like Chris Stone, Kingfish Ingram, Kenny Wayne Shepherd. I mean, these are great folks to work with that, you know, really understand what we're doing, you know, that this is really a celebration of these great songs. They love the collaborative nature of the show itself. And it's fun. It's always fun to have, you know, Eric Johnson's been with us so many times, Zakk Wylde, Kenny. I mean, people, they know what we do. It's a fun thing. Kenny calls it summer camp for the musicians because, you know, you get a break from your own career and you're able to go do something which everybody that's assembled there digs, Jimi Hendrix.
Absolutely, man. It's kind of fun, too, because it's just like it presents a, I would say, varied and diverse, like, swath of different artists that on paper it's like, you don't see, like, you know, what does this person have in common with this other person musically? But I think that's one thing I love about the overall Experience Hendrix thing is that you just see how it is the music of Jimmy that unites everybody, and everybody has that in common. You have people like Eric Johnson. Obviously, Eric is very well known for being a right. huge, you know, Jimmy fan. Some folks, like, I think if they're, you know, if they are aware of, you know, the deeper side of Zakk Wylde beyond, you know, Ozzy Osbourne and, you know, Black Label Society and so on, they're going to know, like, he's a huge music fan. Like, so of course he's a Jimmy fan, but it's just like, you know, there's some of it that perhaps looks a little bit odd when you put it side to side to side that whether it's, you know, Eric and Zach next to each other or whoever you want to point out, when you see it all on stage, like, it instantly makes sense, which is cool.
Yeah, but you know what's funny when you say that? I mean, Hendrix is the common denominator, and he's also that binding agent that they all like. So they're coming at it from a different way. And then I think when you collaboratively present this, and you see Kenny, yes, you can always see Kenny on his own, and he can cover a Jimi Hendrix song, but seeing him in that setting collaborating is unique. Seeing like a Taj Mahal with a Kingfish Ingram, that's incredibly unique. Like, that kind of stuff, as a music fan myself, I'm excited by, which is why, you know, we curate this tour, we pick the artists, we do it. I mean, that's the exciting part of it, is knowing that we're going to throw the audience a curveball, but at the end of it, they're going to walk out of there and say, wow, I went to this show, and while I knew Zach, man, Samantha Fish blew me away, or so-and-so blew me away, you know? And I think that's a fun element to what it is that we do.
100%. I mean, you pointed out something else that's been, you know, historically part of this tour over the years, and that is the opportunity that has been there to see some of the legends like a Taj Mahal that, like, you know, it's just like, how many of us at times have had the chance to see folks like that? And, you know, you never know when it's going to be your last chance to see some of those folks. And you guys have presented some folks, you know, over the years that unfortunately are no longer with us. And it's like, and that's history that was documented along the way, which is very cool, including obviously like in the early part of things, you know, some original members of, you know, Jimmy's bands and stuff like that.
Oh, without question. I mean, Mitch was a part of it and sadly passed away shortly after our tour in 2008. You know, we had Billy Cox for many, many years, every tour we did, and he recently retired. So, you know, I think for us, that there's a nature to this that's really, really fun. I mean, you know, I'll tell you a funny story. We travel on these buses all together, and, you know, the guys, Brad Whitford, for example, from Aerosmith, was amongst a number of people talking to talking to Mitch and asking him questions and, you know, saying, oh, at Monterey, it must have been, you know, all this sex, drugs, rock and roll, crazy. And Mitch just looked at him and said, when we were in Monterey, nobody paid us any mind other than the mamas and papas who were kind to us. Nobody knew who we were, nothing. He said, we were thought of as nothing. He says, afterwards, things changed. But prior to that, he said, people had no clue who we were. So I think it's always great to be able for folks to have access to people, you know, to be able to talk. Like, I have a very fond memory of, you know, Dave Mustaine from Megadeth, who, you know, loved the hang, and you know, I'm sitting in a backstage area, and we're all talking music in this common room. You know, it's really one of the most fun things about the tour. And he's listening to Taj Mahal and asking him a million questions. And I'm thinking, when would you ever see the guy from Megadeth together with Taj Mahal, you know, asking him about like blues people and you know, different interesting things like that. So it's always a fascinating hang.
100%, man. And there are new generations of Jimi Hendrix fans who are understandably fascinated with what they're discovering and hearing, as many others have been over the years. If somebody is new to Jimmy's music, in your opinion, like, what are kind of a few essential tracks that they need to hear?
Well, I mean, the way I look at it is how I came to it. I mean, the first thing I heard was Red House, and that led me, you know, certainly to Smash Hits. And I think if you start there, it's fine. It really doesn't matter. You dip your toe in the Hendrix water, you know, he's going to get you. I think if you're somebody who wants to see what he was all about, certainly if you were to watch him at Woodstock or at the Atlanta Pop Fest or Miami Pop, any of those shows, you're going to Monterey, you're going to be blown away. But I just think that, you know, understanding the opportunity to kind of hear somebody who was a true original, I think that that's such a it doesn't matter where you're from globally, it has an impact on you. I mean, he's one of those people like the Beatles that no matter your age, you want to know, okay, what was that all about? I got to listen to that. And then once you do, you know, you realize just how uniquely original it is. And I think that, you know, our mission is just to kind of get people to come to Jimmy. You know, you don't have to hard sell anybody on that. If you just expose folks to it, they're going to be with you.
One thing I really enjoy about the new box set, Electric Lady Studios, and Jimi Hendrix Vision, is it really kind of gives you an unvarnished look at him just working and exploring his musical visions. There's all the studio chatter. It made me wonder, if we go back, you being somebody who had researched and written extensively about Jimmy prior to getting the job that you have now, like, what were some of the first things that you wanted to hunt down and hear when you got access to the archives?
Well, it's twofold. There were a lot of things that had gone missing. I happen to mention Miami Pop. That was this legendary, you know, performance. And it was actually a show that Eddie Kramer had actually formally recorded. And the tapes and the films were missing. And, you know, it took a lot of detective work, but we were able to find it. Then you have some things where people pop up and they say, oh, you know what? This guy ripped me off back in the day, and I have all these tapes. And if you just settle this, then you're welcome. The family's welcome to have the tapes. So there are those things. So, you know, you always have your antenna up. There's only a finite amount of music and footage of Jimmy, so you're always on the hunt for it. But, you know, going back to something you said earlier, like what would you recommend to something? Man, if you start with Electric Ladyland, you're fine. If you start with Our Experience, you're fine. Band of Gypsies, whatever your pleasure, you know, there's wonderful music in there, and that's going to lead you to, you know, a deeper dive, which is what the Electric Lady Studios box is, because you really nailed it. We specifically were looking to do that by, you know, bringing you into the recording process. So hearing Jimmy talk to Mitch and Billy, hearing the interaction between Jimmy and Eddie Kramer. I mean, that stuff was really important so that you understood, like, wow, this is a guy who, you know, now had his own creative workspace and great things were going to come from it.
Near the end of the first disc of that box set, there is the appropriately labeled The Long Medley. And one can just imagine that there's hours and hours of stuff like that in the archives. Like, what's the story behind kind of that particular stretch of audio?
Well, Jimmy was a guy who didn't read or write music. So think of him as an author who, you know, wrote multiple drafts of a book before coming to, you know, a final edition. So I think The Long Medley, that was a way he would winnow things down by playing them with the guys over and over again, just to make certain refinements. And I think what was so exciting about The Long Medley was that, you know, if you listen to that, there's like six or seven songs in there.
Yeah.
So he's effectively just shifting back to something that he's going to take the guys to later that night or the next day. But, you know, this was his way. He wrote in the studio. That was why it was so important to have a facility like Electric Lady, because, you know, Jimmy wanted to be with his musicians, wanted to be with Eddie Kramer in an environment that was supportive, closed off. He was able to create. And that's what Electric Lady brought him. I mean, you know, you're a fan, I'm a fan, but at the end of the day, this is the first artist to ever own his own commercial recording studio, funded it himself. So that shows you how important it was for him to have that space. And when you listen to the box set, you can hear how excited they are, how great the music sounds, how great the overall tones and sounds are in this new studio. And I think that would have propelled him to so much music, sadly, had he not passed away in September of 1970.
At this point, you've written four books, about related to Jimi Hendrix, et cetera. At the time that you came into the organization, you had written and researched about Jimmy quite a bit. You had written a book. So I'm curious, like, when you come into the organization and you kind of do what you have done with the archives, from what you knew when you came in, like, how did your perspective change once you had like the access that you did and really had the chance to take kind of what would be for us fans the ultimate deep dive?
Well, I think as a fan, you wanted to consume everything. As a researcher and a historian trying to now in turn present his catalog, in a manner in which people will come away with recognizing, you know, particularly now that we're decades from the original creation of this music, the context in which it was created in. I think fans want to know, like, ah, okay, so this is what the Band of Gypsy were all about. This is what Electric Lady Studios was all about. This is what it was like in England working with Chaz Chandler, you know, the first two albums. That's what that was all about. So I think, you know, we've looked at each of these projects to try to present them in a way. You know, an important one for us was a couple of years ago. You know, as a fan growing up and, you know, looking at that Rainbow Bridge movie, which was awful, but to see that little tiny bit of footage that was in that movie, you're like, oh my God, that's amazing. What's this all about? So for us to be able to tell the story of how that was really something his manager wanted, and Jimmy and the guys thought they were going to be in the background in the movie, just as like you'd see a group performing on a stage and it would be Jimi Hendrix. But, you know, after his death, of course, then there was a scramble to try to monetize everything they could that they had in their hands. And so that's what led to, you know, him being shoehorned into that movie. So to be able to tell that story to folks, now they understand, like, ah, okay, so this is what this is all about. You know, had Jimi Hendrix lived, he actually would not have, you know, released this music. When he was approached for that particular project, it was to record an instrumental soundtrack album for a surfing documentary. So, you know, it's important to let folks know on certain things like that. It's also important to just make recordings and footage available so that people can realize, ah, okay, so that's how Electric Ladyland came together. You know, that's kind of what we got to do. It can't be self-serving to the fact that, oh, here's this amazing little jam. You know, we'll make that happen. You got to think broader, and you've got to think about the people like you that are just coming up and becoming aware of who Jimmy was.
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty classic fan moment too, John, like when you see, as you reference, like a tiny bit of footage in a film, and as a fan, you're like going, that's cool. Like, why haven't I seen more of that footage? Like, I would write, you know, that's the moment as a fan where you're going, I would like to watch more of that footage than probably most of the rest of that particular film. So I think it's pretty fascinating as a fan when you hit on moments like that where you just see something and want to know more about it. So yeah, man, it's fascinating then to be able to tell the story of what that kind of micro slice is.
Well, I think that, you know, when you think about Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock, to have been able to tell the real story of how that all came together and, you know, why he wasn't there with the experience and, you know, how even, you know, Star Spangled Banner came to be, you know, in the manner in which he performed it in that memorable way. I just feel like that's important because it's context. And we're lucky in that, you know, we've had, you know, sadly now Chaz and Mitch and Noel and others, Buddy Miles, have passed away.
Yeah.
But we were able to film, you know, in-depth interviews multiple times with them and involve them in the projects. And, you know, having somebody like Eddie Kramer be with us as part of, you know, every project we've done, it's really critical because you're making that direct connection still to the artist in a way that I think, you know, it builds trust with his global audience, and it's just important for us to get it right.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. I mean, watching the Electric Lady film, as you mentioned, like there are folks like, you know, Mitch that, you know, Mitch has been gone at this point since 2008, you know, but you have, because of the work that has been done along the way, it's like you have those folks to speak on behalf of an overall thing like Electric Lady Studios. For you, you know, in the process of putting that film, which people can see as part of this box set together, you know, Electric Lady Studios is for good reason just this place that has been a mythical kind of hallowed place for many years for music fans. What was kind of the interesting or fascinating detail that you kind of uncovered in the process of working on that film?
You know, he was the first artist to fund and own a commercial recording studio. And that in itself was remarkable because, you know, Jimi Hendrix in 1969 was not going to walk into a bank and get a loan, you know, but it was important to him to have this, and he was willing to put up his own money to do it, and did. And, you know, even when there were significant cost overruns, you know, his manager went and got an advance against his royalties from Warner Brothers so that he could continue to do it. So I think that's important to present because it speaks to who Jimi Hendrix was. Like, he didn't necessarily have to have a 50 houses or a Graceland or 20 cars. It wasn't him.
Yeah.
For him, he put his money into, you know, his music was his singular pursuit. And I think he was determined to have a facility like this, because I think, as you hear on the box set, that's where he could sit down and know that, okay, I can, this is my place to write, to record, to bring people in. And had he lived, you can't help but think when Zeppelin's in there, when Stevie Wonder's in there, when all these other artists are in there, hey, let's work together. Let's write a song together. Let me overdub on your record. Let me, you know, all of those things would have materialized from that. And that would have given us so much amazing music. Sadly, you know, his death robbed us all of that.
100%. And, you know, you mentioned early on talking about the archive, like things that, you know, are missing and perhaps, you know, were missing when you came in, things that have come a long way since then. At the time that you came in, had everything in the archive that was there already been transferred and documented? Like, what sort of state was that in when you came in?
No, we there were a lot of things missing that we had to fight to get back. We had to chase folks down. It was a lot of work to solve old problems because, you know, the Hendrix family were new, if you think about it, to the process. They had been, The administration in previously, you know, had not involved them in any way. So it was difficult for them until they got in and could see what needed to be done. And to their credit, Janie Hendricks has always been a champion of going out. If there's audio, film footage, photographs, whatever that helps tell a story we're trying to tell, that we can go ahead and go acquire it and try to bring it into the official library. So, you know, that there's only a finite amount of Jimi Hendrix out there. So to be able to have anything you can to help tell his stories, you know, that's the important part of it. And they knew that back in 95 when they got the rights back. And you know, even today, a couple of years ago, for example, we had somebody pop up who had an amazing recording of him at the Hollywood Bowl in August 67 before Our Experience came out. He'd just been off the Monkees tour, was scrambling, you know, for gigs, and the Mamas and Papas, who had brought him into the Monterey show, said, "Hey, well, you can open for us." So, you know, to be able to have something like that, it fills in a gap in his life story that is important to share with fans.
Yeah, I've talked to Mickey Dolenz about that Monkees Hendrix tour, and that, John, that is such an interesting. Obviously, people are still talking about that tour all these years later because it was such a oddball pairing.
Well, you know, it's eight shows. I mean, he came to Monterey. He was, you know, recommended by Paul McCartney to play there. And while they were in England, his manager, Michael Jeffrey, thought, well, good Lord, the Monkees are huge. They're going to be playing in front of big audiences. This will help jumpstart Jimmy's awareness in America. Whoops. You know, until they got there and realized that, you know, these nine-year-old girls were not happy with, you know, the volume and the stage presentation of Jimi Hendrix. So, you know, I think once, you know, the Monkees were great to Jimmy. I mean, they were always very, you know, Jimmy and Noel and Mitch were always very warm in their comments. And it was vice versa. The Monkees were obviously thrilled with Jimmy, but it wasn't the right fit. And once he was able to, you know, it took a little bit, it took a few weeks. I mean, certainly the Hollywood Bowl gig helped, but I think once he was able to, you know, get out there in the clubs, Our Experience comes out, that's when the rocket took off.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I think fans wonder sometimes how we are still hearing new and unreleased material from Jimmy after all this time. To expand on that, like, how much is there that we still haven't heard?
Well, I mean, over the last 20 odd years, we've really brought out the bulk of it. I think when you think about Jimi Hendrix, he was somebody who was always ahead of his audience. And by that, I mean, you know, he was recording and recording and recording because prior to his fame, he had been denied that opportunity. So, you know, just for him to have struggled so hard to finally reach the position that he was in, and then the idea of owning your own studio, I mean, that for him was like, I mean, I could do this all day long. And I think, you know, we were lucky in that he put down so much music that we were able to, you know, as I say, look at all these respective chapters of his life and career and bring it to fans in a way that we hope, you know, gives them a deeper appreciation and understanding for where he was. There's a lot of music there, hundreds of hours. You know, some of it is things that are in development. And I think like we did on the Electric Lady Studios box set, you know, presenting it in a particular manner allows for people to realize, ah, okay, so this isn't Electric Ladyland Part 2, but this is like where he was going at the time of his death. So that reveals something that's important. But, you know, we also have an official bootleg label that we started called Dagger Records, which is, you know, if you go to jimihendrix.com, you can learn about. And, you know, there you can hear more of the deeper dive things. But, you know, at the end of the day, if all you got Access Bold is love, you're in good shape. And then, you know, it's going to lead you to more. And, you know, our job has been to try to put things out there that, you know, once you take that next step, it leads you to the next one because you're excited by that. And you're like, well, now I got to hear Band of Gypsies.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, man, about this box set, one thing that jumped out at me was I loved hearing something like Drifting, which already has a good amount of polish, even though it's like first couple takes. But Jimmy, what stuck out to me about that is Jimmy had this ability to project a certain vulnerability with his vocals, and I think you hear that on that song.
Oh, you do. I absolutely think you do. And you know, I think the stripped down version of Angel is similar in that way too.
For sure.
You know, it's, I mean, as much as Mitch was trying to do it justice posthumously by adding, you know, some of the additional drums and the work that he did that's on the Cry of Love version, I think hearing it here, just the three guys on the floor, you know, it's a beautiful ballad. And, you know, Jimmy, for all of his, you know, when you think of him as this dynamic stage performer, this is also the guy who created Castles Made of Sand, Little Wing, When Cries Mary. So, you know, his skill at ballads, you know, is, if you can say it, is undervalued.
Well, just a few more things from my side of things, and then we'll wrap. One of the things that, as I understand it, you worked on in the early 90s was the Stone Free tribute album, correct?
That is correct, absolutely, yes.
Man, I love that thing. It's just such a fascinating listen, even now. What are some of your favorite memories now of working on that project?
You know, one of my favorites, quite honestly, was, you know, I was a longtime Jeff Beck fan, and that was the first time I really got to work with him. And, you know, he originally, we had discussed recording with Seal and doing When Cries Mary. And Jeff loved the idea. And, he called me once. And for me, you know, it was in the middle of the night, but because I was in the U.S. and he was over there. And he just said, hey, man, I want to do Manic Depression. We got to do Manic Depression. I really want to do that. I was like, okay, great. it's like you pinch yourself. Am I having this conversation with Jeff Beck? But so, and that's the track that made the record. And, you know, it was extraordinary. So, you know, there were a lot of wonderful memories from that project. It was a fun project to do, not dissimilar to, you know, the Experience Hendrix tour, where you get to work with artists who love Jimmy. And there really isn't a song they don't like. It's really ones that are special to them and they want to do. And, you know, for me, doing, you know, Red House with Buddy Guy on that album was really special. I loved what, you know, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden did, pairing together to create Hey Baby. That was a memorable thing. So a wonderful project. It still funds scholarships in Jimmy's name at the United Good College Fund even today.
That's fantastic, man. And, you know, similar to Experience Hendrix, I think that it showed the depth of people who are fans. You don't necessarily think that The Cure would be into Jimi Hendrix, but it shows just how deep that influence went.
You know, and Jeff Gold at Warner Brothers Records deserves credit for that, because, you know, I was aware of The Cure's music. I enjoyed it. I'd heard that Robert Smith was a big fan, but he had said to me, look, you know, this is somebody really, you know, let's think about it. And they came back and said they wanted to do Purple Haze. I was like, okay. And they did. And it ended up being a big track from that record. It got a lot of radio play, and people were really surprised that, you know, that The Cure kind of embraced Jimi Hendrix in the manner in which they did. Another one, which was, you know, really interesting, was PM Dawn. I mean,
yeah,
you know, their version of that song actually got a lot of radio play and brought a lot of folks to the party that I think, you know, really weren't aware of Jimmy's influence, you know, kind of stretching into that direction.
Look, man, it's work, but were you able to be around for some of those sessions?
Of course, absolutely, yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, not everyone, because a lot of it was going on simultaneously. But, you know, I mean, we were the one that I was not able to do was actually the Clapton one.
Oh.
But because I was in the studio with Eddie and with Paul Rogers and Slash out on the West Coast. So, you know, sometimes you just had to kind of pick your spots. But it was just a fun project. And, you know, we knew what they were doing. We had talked to them about that and knew that, you know, Eric was going to record two songs. One was Burning of the Midnight Lamp, and the second was Stone Free. And when we heard Stone Free, we were like, okay, this is the one for the record.
And how did the idea come up to pair him with the guys from Chic?
That actually was Eric's idea.
Fantastic.
I think he really wanted to step out and do something different. You know, he worked with Nile Rodgers on that track. He wanted him to produce it. And I think, you know, that was a really cool idea, you know, by Niles to kind of, you know, bring a Band of Gypsies vibe to Eric. So I thought that was the intent, and I thought they did a great job.
Well, that had to be a pretty magical session to be around, as you mentioned, being there with, you know, Slash and Paul and, you know, the Band of Gypsies guys. Like, that had to be a pretty cool thing to be.
It really was. It,
yeah.
You know, Paul's one of the nicest guys, obviously a brilliant vocalist, wonderful guy. Billy and Buddy were wonderful, and Slash was just great. He was so determined to, you know, and this was at the height of GNR when they were really, you know, just blowing up. And I think for him, like, he just wanted to get it right. It was important to him to do so. And that was a beginning of a nice friendship. And he's, you know, that guy just to him, Jimi Hendrix is really a special artist, and you hear it, you feel it, you know. And again, that was another track from that album that, you know, rock radio really embraced and played a great deal.
Well, here's the final thing from my side, and that just is, you know, obviously with this box set for folks to enjoy, experience Hendrix the tour coming up here in March and April. You guys always have something cooking. Like, what's kind of ahead that's kind of being worked on that you want folks to know about presently?
Well, you know, the Electric Lady Studio project was a long project in the making. So, you know, that's our present one. We're promoting it. We're out there. You know, that's the one for fans to really drink in. There's a lot of music there, so we're not going to step on top of that with something. You know, we're looking at some things going forward, but, you know, nothing has been determined. Nothing has been set. So, you know, right now our feeling is like, hey, there's a lot of music there. Enjoy the doc. You know, the doc has gone from theatrical to, you know, now starting to work its way up on the, you know, on the streaming platforms and things of that nature. So, you know, it'll be a little bit, but this is the one to enjoy for the moment.
Well, fantastic, John. I'll let you run on, man. Thank you so much for the time today.
Oh, man, thank you. I appreciate you having me, and I appreciate your patience.
Take care. No worries. Bye-bye.
Thank you, man. Take care.
There you have it. Another episode of the UCR Podcast is in the books. I am Matt Wardlaw. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. Please make sure to follow this podcast if you haven't, so you will get future episodes as they're released. And we'd appreciate it also if you would rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. Look, we are all music fans, so if you enjoyed this, you can find a lot more at ultimateclassicrock.com, and we'll see you there.